loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Political warfare among different factions of the political establishment in the aftermath of the firing of FBI Director James Comey by Donald Trump continues as Acting Director Andrew McCabe took Comey's seat at a Senate intelligence hearing on Russia. The final debate in Iran's presidential election campaign will take place today. President Hassan Rouhani has come out swinging in recent days as he hopes for a re-election next week. What's at stake in the landmark election for the country, the region, and the world? The Arctic Council has been holding its summit in Alaska, in which Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was present, along with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov, as the climate changes. Is the Arctic a new site of geopolitical tension, a new cold or colder war? But first, we turn to the continued fallout from Donald Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey. We are joined from New York by former CIA analyst and political activist Ray McGovern. You can read his writings at raymcgovern.com. Welcome back, Ray.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you for joining. Of course, no news is bigger than the news that Donald Trump fired the FBI Director James Comey. And since then, the Democratic Party and many of its supporters have been making the argument that the reason that Trump sacked Comey was that Comey was in charge of the investigation into alleged Russian meddling with the U.S. election and in support of Donald Trump. And of course, in the last week, James Comey has said as much. He also said that he was mildly nauseous over the possible impact that he had when he came out both in July and October 28th about FBI's investigation in Hillary Clinton. Why do you think Trump fired Comey?
Well, I think that the president found out that Comey was not to be trusted, not in the least, that he was part of a cabal, including John Brennan of the CIA and the NSA director, to make it appear to the American people that it was President Trump. I'm sorry, there's President Putin that gave the election to President Trump. The notion that more investigators were needed, well, in one sense, that's true. What Comey admitted before the House Intelligence Committee was that he was unable, as he put it, to get access to the Democratic National Committee computers. Now, that's silly on the face of it. The director of the FBI can always get direct access. Why did he not seek direct access? Because he knew he was in with the NSA and the CIA, and he knew that if investigators really went in there, they would find out that it was not the Russians that hacked the Democratic National Committee. It was the CIA. Let me explain. This has gotten no attention in the mainstream press. But on the 31st of March, WikiLeaks released news that a new program developed by CIA and NSA hides fragments of tests and allows the CIA to make believe that another party is blamed for the hack. Russian, Chinese, Farsi, Arabic, and Korean were the languages used. The forensic investigation and the antivirus companies were completely befuddled by that. Why? Because as the former technical director of NSA has told me, this is a program that took 15 years to complete and that there are 700 million lines of code in it. Okay? That means that an outfit like CrowdStrike cannot possibly detect who the real hacker was, but rather can only detect the signs, the telltale signs that the real hacker left behind. And those were Sir Relic and the name of the first head of the Russian secret police. So they can't have it both ways. If the Russians did it, they wouldn't have left behind telltale signs. We know now that Brennan had this capability. My friends and I concur that I can say with their support that it's just as likely, if not more likely, that it was John Brennan and the CIA that hacked into those DNC computers with a very specific program designed to blame someone else, namely the Russians. Was this program used in 2016? Yes, it was. Again, this is based on original CIA documents revealed by Julian Assange on the 31st of March. No wonder they hate him so much.
Okay, Ray, let's go back for our broader audience, which is probably not following this as closely as certainly as you are or William Binney, the NSA technical director that you are referring to. We had a situation where the FBI told the Democratic National Committee that their email server had been hacked. That's what the FBI told them. The FBI asked for the Democratic National Committee to give permission to the FBI to come and do a forensic investigation into the DNC hack. And the DNC said no. Now, what you're suggesting, I think, is that certainly the FBI, if it wanted to, could have found a way to force, perhaps through subpoena, the Democratic Party to give over its email server so that the FBI could look into it if indeed a foreign government was trying to influence through illegal interference the outcome of an American election.
And that's beyond dispute.
And that James Comey, who was then director of the FBI, did not pursue the investigation. And so CrowdStrike, which was the Democratic National Committee's private sort of customer service for their email protection, their so-called security guarantee, they were the only source of information about the Russian leak. In other words, that's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, and what I'm saying is that if you look at Comey's testimony before the House Intelligence Committee, he was squirming. He said, and this is a virtual direct quote, I know it's far better if you're doing forensics to get actual physical access to the computers in question, but we didn't do that. I know it would have been better to do that, but we had to rely on CrowdStrike. Now, CrowdStrike, what is their capability? Whatever it is, it's not sufficient to uncover a program 15 years in the making with 700 million lines of code, each line costing $25, as Bill Binney has explained to me. So this is really, really amazing. I think someone finally told Trump, look, this Comey, this Comey is in with John Brennan of the CIA and in with the NSA. They're out to destroy you. They haven't done it yet, but they're still going to work on it. They're going to put more investigators on it, and you bet your money they're going to find collusion between you, or if not at least you, then some of your folks. And that's why I think Trump said, this is it. You know, I'm not going to tolerate this guy anymore.
Ray,
fired him.
Ray, let me ask you, let me give you a counter scenario and then let you respond to it if I could.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. The sort of emerging narrative that's coming through, at least in some of the media here in Washington, D.C., is that Donald Trump had never liked Comey, that he had denounced Comey over and over again during the 2016 campaign because Comey was not indicting Hillary Clinton, instead simply saying that, you know, she was extremely reckless in allowing her email server, which she had taken home, the State Department server, to be put on her personal server. He was angry at Comey. He wanted to get rid of Comey for a long time, and that he was getting increasingly agitated because Donald Trump sits and watches cable TV all the time, watching Comey on TV when he testified, say, at the May 3rd hearings, where Comey said he was mildly nauseous over the fact that he possibly had an impact on the 2016 election, meaning the defeat of Hillary Clinton. That you could only take the mildly nauseous to mean that. And he also let me just finish and then you have you respond. And Comey at that hearing also confirmed that he wanted to go public with his concerns that Russia was meddling with the election back in August 2016, but that it was the Obama administration that squashed it. In other words, he wanted to let people know back then that the Russians were trying to help Donald Trump. And Comey said he believes Russia will try to meddle with the 2018 midterm elections. Now, all of those things, if Donald Trump is sitting there getting annoyed and angry at the FBI director, already doesn't like him, and the Democrats were also trashing Comey at the same time because of his misstatements at those hearings about Hillary Clinton. In other words, exaggerating the role of Hillary Clinton's emails and how many she had sent and how many were classified, etc., that Donald Trump then acted in an imperious, sort of impulsive way because he's the boss. This is the way he does things. And he expected the Democrats to basically applaud his announcement because they already seem to have so many grievances against him. What do you think about that narrative?
Well, I think all the reasons that you so far, including the ones that you just used, are bogus. It has to do with trust. Now, the Democrats are just as vehement in opposing Comey and accusing him of various misdeeds. What we need is some major event where Trump finally knows that Comey not only was inept as an investigator, but the very fact that he did not require the DNC to surrender their computers so that his technicians would look at it and find out what? That the Russians hacked? Not in your life. He would find that John Brennan and the CIA had this very fancy program, and the only way they could figure out what happened would be to go to NSA and ask them to rat on themselves. That's how I look at it. Now, the whole thing here about the investigation, a special prosecutor and all that, Glenn Greenwald was on this morning, and he made some good sense. He said, look, he said, if you compare it to Watergate, there was underlying criminal activity in Watergate. That's why it started getting momentum. There is no evidence of underlying criminal activity with respect to this so-called hack by the Russians. And the reason for that is that there is no hack by the Russians. The Russians were recipients, that is, WikiLeaks was recipient of a leak. And when you put that together, you see that, you know, this rare firing of the FBI director, well, in my view, Trump was well within his authorities, and he risked something for sure. But he knows that any legitimate investigation will turn up, not that the Russians hacked to help him win and thereby make him sort of an unauthorized president, but rather that this is a much more complicated business, as he's willing to face that prospect, even though it would drag out for 2 years. If there's a good prosecutor, a special prosecutor named, he's going to get to the bottom of this. And Trump, I think, is confident that he will be able to prove that Comey was, together with John Brennan and with the NSA directors, culpable of first trying to deny him the election and then later impugning his authenticity or his right to be president. They're still at it. And that's what's going on here. Trump had enough, and so he fired Comey.
Well, certainly the way he fired Comey and the way this has played out, it appeared that many of people in the top parts of his own administration, you know, did not know it was going to happen. They were taken off guard. The Democratic Party, the opponents of Trump, were able to seize the high ground along with the major media, which has been going at Trump anyway, except when he drops bombs on Syria. I mean, they grabbed hold of it. They're going out. The Move On, the fake protest organization that's a front group for the Democratic Party, as in my opinion, went to in front of the White House and held a demonstration for calling for a special prosecutor to look into the Trump-Russia connection. If it was designed in some way to sort of impede that project, it certainly had the opposite impact because it's accelerated it a great deal. I agree with you 100%. The difference between Watergate and this is that when Nixon fired Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, well, when he demanded that his attorney general do it, and then the attorney general resigned because he wouldn't do it, that's because Archibald Cox had evidence and Nixon was about to get impeached or, you know, whatever because
yeah, there
of... There was evidence. Yeah, there was evidence here. There's no evidence whatsoever.
Well, that's the key. And the professionals in the FBI know that. They also know something that Sally Yates tried to say two times during her testimony on Monday. And that was, I never asked for any unmasking. What happens is some of these intercepted messages, they come to me with the American names already unmasked. And they come from the intelligence agencies. That's what she said. She was cut off both times short. Now, what does that mean? That means that when John Brennan and Comey and the NSA people decided that they would tell Sally Yates, oh, look, we have proof now. We have proof now that Michael Flynn was lying. Now you better tell. You better tell the president, or you tell the vice president. Well, she was had. She was persuaded that this was her duty to do. Now, did she ask for those names to be unmasked? No, she tried to say twice on Monday, I never asked. It was given to me unmasked. Who did that? The only people I can, NSA, CIA, and the FBI. And it worked like a charm because she toted off to the White House and said, oh, this is terrible. And the White House said, well, you know, what business of yours if one part of the administration is not candid with the other part? And she said, well, the blackmail. The blackmail thing is just so stretched. I can't believe that even the Americans impoverished on the diet of information that they get, that Americans believe the business that Michael Flynn would have been open to blackmail by the Russians because he didn't tell the vice president the whole truth. That just doesn't wash. So the whole thing is a charade, and Trump knows it's a charade now. He may have Mike Pompeo, the head of the CIA, doing some real investigation here and finding out, whoops, John Brennan had this whole directorate full of computer hacks. They were really good at hacking and disguising the provenance of the hacking. They were not so good at defense. Witness the fact that WikiLeaks and Julian Assange has a treasure trove of which they've only released so far a minuscule proportion. And I would say look for more, but look especially at the number three release, which was released on March 31st. No wonder the New York Times gave it no heed or any other publications because it shows. What it shows is that the CIA has the capability to hamper forensic investigations and to prevent antivirus companies from attributing hacking attacks to the CIA. Instead, they attribute them to whom? To the Russians. So the last thing I'll say here is this is very dangerous. You know, we have a distraction from what Trump wanted to do in creating a decent relationship with the Russians. Now it's really hard for him to do that. And what you have now is a really sobering, a really somber reminder that continuity and escalation is happening with respect to the wars that we're engaged in. And these are wars that Russia could help us get out of, especially the one in Syria. We had an agreement in September, and who botched that one? Our Defense Department by bombing fixed Syrian army positions, killing between 70 and 100 people.
We are completely out of time. Completely out of time. We've been joined by Ray McGovern. We've been talking about the firing of James Comey, the FBI director. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The final debate in Iran's presidential election campaign will take place today. President Hassan Rouhani has come out swinging in recent days as he hopes for a re-election next week. What's at stake in the landmark election for the country, the region, and the world? We are joined from London by Masoud Shajarei. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Welcome back, Masoud.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. Today is the final debate in Iran's presidential election. Can you talk about the importance of this particular election and who the candidates are?
Well, the importance of this election is obviously it comes after the nuclear deal which was made, which many in Iran see that it's a deal that has not been honored by the 5+1. And the fact is that is at the time that Trump is in presidency rather than Obama. And, you know, everyone is much more touchy regarding what's going to happen in Middle East, what is going to happen in North Korea. And indeed, we are seeing to somewhat since Trump's election and victory and his presidency, we hearing more of drums of war. with regard to Iran and North Korea, etc. So these are this election is very sensitive and very, very important in many ways.
So talk about the candidates. And is Rouhani, you know, the favorite at this point? And talk about who the supreme leader Khamenei favors, if you can tell.
Well, and the fact of the matter is that in all the history of democracy in Iran since the revolution, every president has actually done two terms, the full two terms, which is allowed. And not even a single of the presidents have actually done only one term. And in many ways, they really walked through the second term, all of them. And here, this particular time, it's actually observers are not sure. I mean, it's not so certain that Rouhani will be reelected. And although at the moment, among the sort of there are mainly three main realistic possibilities is Rouhani and is Ghalibaf, which is the mayor, current mayor of Tehran, and Hujjat al-Islam Raisi, who is in charge of the largest NGO in Iran, which in Mashhad, which actually looks after the Imam Reza's sort of investment and waqf. So basically is one of these three. And at the moment, Rouhani, although he's in front, but the other two are actually quite making a lot of move. And Rouhani has in past few weeks have lost some ground to the other two. And it seems that it's going to go for the second level of the voting, i.e. Rouhani is not going to be able to get over 50%. So he will go best of the two. And in that case, Rouhani will be in serious difficulty, because in the way that the West actually sort of names the different grouping in Iran, Rouhani is supposedly been identified as reformist. And the other two are from a camp which in the West they refer to them as hardliner, but in Iran they're referred to as principal or conservative. And so on the second round, if it goes to the second round, and the conservative combined voting will be actually more than what Rouhani currently is polling.
Right. So let's just talk about why this might be so close, given the fact that, as you said, since the 1979 revolution and the beginning of Iran's democracy, the incumbent has always won. The president has always won a second term. Is it because there's a difference, a political cleavage in the summits of the Iranian establishment between the so-called reformists or moderates, as they're called in the Western media, and what you are saying is the principalists, or again, the sort of caricatured label in the Western media is the hardliners? What's the basis of the difference, and what's the basis of the difference in the sort of the different points of support within Iranian society? In other words, does Rouhani's position or the reformist position, however we label it, also correspond to a class base of support within Iran, or is it simply about temperament, religion, politics, in other words, ideology or theology, or is there a class basis to this division?
Well, there is a division. I mean, like anywhere else in the world, if you say two grouping or two parties or different parties, they do have some hardcore support that no matter what, people vote in certain direction because of the ideology, because of class, indeed, and because of other aspect. But there is, like anywhere else, there are floating voters. And Iran is no different to that. And the fact of the matter is that it really nothing to do with the issues of these caricature definitions of hardliners and so forth and moderates and so on and so forth. Because Rouhani has not changed his position. over the last sort of 10 years or even beyond that. Everybody knows he is from the camp of reformists. And he actually won the election quite conveniently and very sort of precisely at the last election. So really what is happening, the people who are turning away from Rouhani currently, and which is the cause of him being in some difficulty, is not because of ideology, but is because of the sort of the last experience, the experience of last 4 years of his presidency, and in particular goes back to the issue of the economy. The argument was by Rouhani and many Iranians is that the plight of the economy in Iran is because of sanctions, and then therefore, you know, Iran got involved in discussion, and indeed sort of the agreement between Iran and 5+1 was something that was supported more or less by the majority of the Iranians, and there was a support for it. There was a section of the community which was opposing to it, but they weren't in a major section of the society. But what has actually happened is that the result of this agreement and the fact that the West have actually failed to uphold its part in these agreements, and the United States in particular, the fact that even Iranian money, which was frozen around the world, have not been released, the money which was due to Iran because of the sales of oil, etc., have not really reached the Iranian shores, and the problem with the banking system, which still is locked out. Iran is locked out of that banking system and is not able to get involved in the commerce. Is the reason that many Iranians are saying, well, you know, why did we go and do all this thing? We have gone and we have gone and agreed on a certain agreement. We have upheld our part of the bargain, which indeed Iran has and has been sort of clarified and identified and testified by all international apparatus and institutions. But the West has not upheld its part of the bargain. So people actually see that as a failure of Rouhani, not the failure of anyone else, the failure of Rouhani, because Rouhani was in charge of those negotiations. And indeed, he actually sort of attached his future to the victory and the of this deal. And the fact that that has gone pear-shaped is got a lot to do with the fact that people are saying, well, he's not a man that could deliver.
The Rouhani attended a rally a few days ago and was quoted by the Financial Times. Again, we don't know if that's a good quote because, I mean, they're not, you know, a Farsi language newspaper. They're an English language newspaper, and we know a lot of things get changed in translation. But he was quoted in the Financial Times as saying to the crowd, "We are here to tell pro-violence extremists that your era has come to an end. You," and then the paper puts in brackets, "hardliners," close bracket, "cannot stand against our youth's choice for freedom and progress." The article said that he was supported at the rally by those in the, quote, pro-democracy movement and groups. Presumably that would mean those who in 2009 would have been with the Green Movement that was trying to overcome or overturn or denounce the legitimacy of the second election of Ahmadinejad. Talk about that, if you would, and what's Rouhani actually saying right there. And then I want to ask you a follow-up question again about one of his comments.
Right. And what we have seen in Iran, that the election, especially in the last few weeks, have become very aggressive and very abusive in some way. We've seen similar sort of situation in elsewhere, you know, in elections in the United States and in France and elsewhere, and currently in Britain, we are seeing things hotting up and people becoming abusive and so forth. But in Iran, this is actually sort of quite unusual, and it's gone far beyond what people are comfortable with. Most of the people I speak to from different backgrounds and so forth, one thing they say very clearly that we are very concerned of the language and the tone of voice that is being used. I mean, I don't confirm or agree with the translation of it, but nevertheless, it is true that the language has become much more abusive. The sort of accusations of one another from the candidate is becoming quite aggressive. And Rouhani is actually leading that. And that's why many observers, and indeed even foreign Western observers, have come to the conclusion that this is why. The reason why he's doing this is because he's actually looking at the polls and seeing that he's losing popularity. So he's out of desperation that he's going down this road. And only a few days ago, Ayatollah Khamenei actually gave a very, very strong and very clear warning that although, you know, elections is something that is could be very beneficial to the whole society and the security of the society, but going beyond certain sort of lines, red lines, it actually brings insecurity and it could create problem for the society. You know, it's very difficult to pump up and sort of charge your followers with accusations and predictions and so forth. And then as soon as the voting finish, you expect them to calm down and go back to normal. And unfortunately, I think Rouhani is leading a very dangerous sort of line of electioneering, which is very aggressive, very abusive, and it sort of goes beyond the red lines, I would say. And this is what is very clearly happening.
So Masoud, so you're saying that the aggressiveness isn't coming from the, quote, hardliners per se. It's coming, it may be from both sides, but it's also coming from Rouhani's camp or from Rouhani himself. I want to ask you that, but I let me just ask you one other quick question because we only have 90 seconds and then you can finish up on both of them. The presumably when Rouhani was speaking about the same candidate, again, that's Raisi, Ibrahim Raisi, when he told the crowd in Hamadan, quote, "This month the nation will once again reject those whose main decisions have only been executions and imprisonments over the past 38 years. That's very heated up language against your political opponents. Okay, go ahead. 90 seconds left.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, the conversations are hotting up, but as I said, Rouhani is leading this, and you know, to use that sort of language against someone who has actually been in judiciary for such a long time is very abusive, especially when people in Rouhani's camp, everybody knows within Iran, have been sort of people who actually committed things which is not very savory. And indeed, they sort of been involved in similar structures within the Iranian structures. And you know, this sort of thing actually divides the society and divides the community and demonize the other. And I think this is what the red line that Ayatollah Khamenei was talking about. The sort of the hardliners, so-called, or the conservatives, they are basically working on the record, past record of 4 years, especially on the deal which was made. And they targeting that sort of thing. While obviously Rouhani can't do that because they are not the sort of sitting president. So he actually starts targeting them on much more either personal situation or indeed sort of accusations, which are very demonizing and aggressive.
All right, we're out of time. We've been joined from London by Masoud Shajarei. Masoud, when the election happens or just on the eve of the election, we'll want to talk again about this because Iran is a major country in the world and, of course, a major country in the region. And what happens in the election will not only impact Iran and the people of Iran, but the entire world. We've been talking to Masoud Shajarei. He is the co-founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The Arctic Council has been holding its summit in Alaska, in which Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was present, along with Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov. As the climate changes, is the Arctic a new site of geopolitical tension, a new site for militarization, a new cold or colder war? We are joined by Greg Mello. He is a co-founder of the Los Alamos Study Group. Welcome, Greg.
Welcome. Nice to be here.
Thank you for rejoining us once again. What is the Arctic Council? It's Canada, Russia, the U.S., as well as Finland, Denmark, Norway, Iceland, and Sweden. They take part in it. But what is it, and is it vital to the securing of peace or cooperation? Is that its goal in the Arctic?
Yes, that and development. It doesn't make policy. It doesn't dispense money. It's a forum for talking and trying to resolve differences and setting the stage for better things.
Right. And better things would be needed because, as we know, all around, certainly in the Middle East and certainly in Eastern Europe and all along the borders of Russia, there's been a growing sense of confrontation between Russia and the United States. It would seem to me that if the Arctic is melting and that's becoming the new battlefield, instead of cooperation, it might lead to a real arms race in the Arctic.
Yes, it could, and that would be terrible. The Arctic is extremely fragile. It is a climate battleground, and it's possibly where humanity's fate will be decided, how well we take care of the Arctic, and we're not taking care of it well. It's incredibly important for these countries to be able to get together and talk, and it's great that it's very far from Washington, D.C.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I want to just read something from a magazine called Modern Diplomacy. With the rapid melting ice in the Arctic region, the long isolated region is becoming more accessible zone for commercial fishing, freshwater, mineral, coal, iron, copper, oil, gas, and shipping. Thus, like the region, is increasingly catching the world powers' attention. It seems to me, Greg, that the last thing that the world needs in the face of this giant unknown and possibly catastrophic development, that is the Arctic melting in terms of global warming, the last thing we would need to be doing is competing over the extraction of now accessible mineral wealth. And the last thing we would need to be doing is preparing for a confrontation, military confrontation. In other words, it says something about the world that as soon as some place becomes accessible, it becomes like the new battlefield or the new place where capitalist competition can run amok.
Yes, I agree. And it seems completely needless. I don't think there's, Shell tried to drill there in the Arctic and they found it very difficult and very expensive. No doubt there's a lot of resources there, but the price of commodities is down. It has been down. And it could be, instead of a place for greater confrontation, it could be a real opportunity to start talking in a more productive and constructive way.
Right. Unfortunately, it seems that each side when we're operating within the framework of sovereign nation states and there's so much militarism in the world, each side doesn't really trust the other side, the other nations, the other sovereigns, to move peacefully into an area. They fear that any advantage secured either economically or militarily will be at the expense of the other. And so that compels all sides to do that which may be, from a species point of view, fundamentally harmful. But they can't see it from that point of view. The policymakers are driven by other considerations. What would be the possible, given the fact that this is such a fundamental issue, what would be the possible basis for a real agreement before this gets out of hand?
Well, that's a very good question. A real agreement would start with clarifying some of the basic facts about the Arctic. That would, of course, be news to the Trump administration and possibly in Russia as well. It's hard for states that and diplomats whose past and present are tied up with fossil fuels to kind of say, you know, we're going to have to leave most of the remaining fossil fuels in the ground. I mean, that's a very hard message to absorb, and I think there's a basic science gap. There's fantastic Russian scientists working in the Arctic as well as American scientists, so one place to start would be expanded cooperative science efforts in the Arctic, both on the land and on the sea. Russia, more so than anywhere else, has extensive shallow Arctic seas where there are vulnerable deposits of methane clathrates, which, if they should get too warm, could release fantastic amounts of methane into the atmosphere, which would be extremely dangerous and perhaps even fatal to most life, as has happened before. So scientific cooperation is certainly one thing. I think there could be some military deconfliction. I think some steps to prevent accidents, that's always a good place to start. There could be oil and gas moratoria. They could be small in the beginning, but maybe some of the most delicate and fantastically important areas for wildlife could be set aside just as a start. And people could agree to keep on talking. It's wonderful that the presidency of the council is passing to Finland because they're not a NATO country and they're not either Russia or the U.S., so that's helpful. So there are plenty of possible positive outcomes here, but I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that this diplomacy is taking place, is just that it's taking place at all, because it's been the relationship between the U.S. and Russia is in the toilet, as Foreign Minister Lavrov said the other day.
Right, and it is. And some of the media reports in the West, and these came not when relations are at such a low point, but earlier, several years ago, made note of the fact that in 2007, Russian scientists dived to the seabed in the Arctic Ocean and planted what the Western media said was a titanium Russian flag. Russia claimed that it was only the flag of Russia's ruling party, but nonetheless, that Russia did that in order to beef up its claims, and Russia had already moved to restore a Soviet-era military base and other military outposts in the Arctic. What's the U.S. doing in the Arctic, as you can see it? Is it open? Do we know what it is?
I certainly don't know the extent of it. We have warning systems. I guess I shouldn't say that for sure. There always were radar systems up there, but perhaps we're entirely dependent on satellites now. I'm not sure. So the Arctic is it's important militarily because that's where U.S. and Russia are the closest across there, and I'm sure that submarines traverse those waters, and the full extent of the Cold War infrastructure up there and how much of it is still being used and how much new there is, I'm not sure I could say.
Right. One thing that we know is that when there was colonial expansion or overseas expansion by any of the powers that had expansionist designs, say in the 16th century or 17th century or 18th century, starting, of course, featured by the voyage of Christopher Columbus, it required not only the, sort of visiting an area, but it required sending people, colonial subjects who could, do the bidding of those major powers. They set up shop. They were representatives of. And in many ways, they established a military presence in new areas. And of course, in the case of the United States has, I don't know how many, maybe 800 or 900 or 1,000 military bases littered all over the world, like perhaps in 130 or 140 countries. In the case of the Arctic, it's hard for human beings to actually be there or to be there in large numbers. How does that impact this situation? In other words, does it make it more likely that there could, in fact, be cooperation?
I should think so. And, of course, when we speak of Cold War competition, Canada's and Denmark and Iceland have, and Norway, especially in many ways, Norway's very important as well. Their Arctic presence is our Arctic presence. And so that's part of the mystery of it for us. They handle that for us in some way. But yes, I think that's right. But again, the devil will be in the details.
Right. So when we look at the big picture here, because you're looking at militarism, Los Alamos Study Group is looking at militarism all over the place. We have different regions of the planet where there's points of contention, there's points of military expansion. There's also outer space, another area where people are competing instead of just having a peaceful cooperation, even though there is cooperation at different levels in outer space. Many in the Pentagon are viewing outer space as like the new high ground, the new battlefield. And I just wonder if they see the Arctic in a similar kind of way. In other words, what would be the advantage that the United States could, I mean, given the fact that all of the powers are paying attention right now to this region, what could the U.S. actually do to gain the upper hand? I mean, is it really feasible under these circumstances?
No, I don't think so. Upper hand, you know, the Arctic is a flyover zone for the U.S.-Russian competition in a lot of ways. So, you know, it's what the warheads see when they look down. And it's where the B-52 patterns are flown and where Russian air defenses are tested by U.S. air probed and tested and where special forces might land and that sort of thing. And it's as if, you know, it's another planet, except environmentally, it's vastly important. And I think listeners may not grasp, because it's so difficult to grasp, that the Arctic melting is a national security crisis of the first magnitude. It's not under control. It's very rapid. It has positive feedbacks built into it. So when the ice melts, the sea is darker. When the snow melts, the land is darker. So it absorbs more heat. So it melts more. Change up the weather, climate change we're seeing in the Arctic is not linear, and it's completely out of proportion to what we see down here. It's sudden. So we get, you know, the jet stream coming down into the continental United U.S., and it's very cold. Well, it's coming down because warm air is going up into the Arctic to replace that air, and it's getting very warm, like 40, 50 degrees warmer than normal. So we're seeing a catastrophic fall off in ice, which means a catastrophic environmental change for the creatures that live there, but also a catastrophic change in the reflectivity of the Arctic and its ability to stay cold. So when the Arctic warms up, if it should warm up and become, say, ice-free, then it will be extremely difficult to control global warming. And so the Arctic is really a very vulnerable canary, if you want to use that that metaphor, a canary in the mine. And we really need to pay very close attention. And that's the nature of the national security crisis in the Arctic, more than the conventional national security crisis, which, of course, we can't neglect either.
Yeah, it's so true. I'm grateful to you for putting it in that perspective. I mean, in World War II, which by far was the worst, the greatest and the worst of all wars, perhaps 80 million people died. But in a planet where there's 7 billion human beings, a very abrupt change in climate and rising sea waters could make the casualty numbers in World War II look minor in comparison to what we're actually facing. there seems to be a surprise, actually, or shock by the scientific community about the dynamism of the ice melt in the Arctic. Is that right?
Yes, there is. There is. And that's partly a public relations phenomenon, or because, you know, scientists are conservative about their findings. They want to be really sure before they write something up and it's peer-reviewed. They don't want to be wrong and have their careers ruined, so they'd rather be sure they're right. So if they think something is happening and they're, say, 75% sure, that's not enough to publish usually. But in this case, in the case of the ice melting, what we learn is happening so quickly that it's outpacing the conservatism of the science, and then that gets captured by the news media that has been then slow to respond also. So yes, the scientists are surprised, and then that surprise gets, you know, the IPCC is where you have a consensus process to approve the report. That's the most conservative way of all, and so that makes that really lag behind.
Yeah, so what is called in popular vernacular, at least, is an abrupt climate change, which has happened during the existence of the planet, leading to major catastrophes and major extinctions, right? I mean, we have about 40 seconds left.
Yes, it has, and it, I mean, the climate can change abruptly in a period as small as 10 years, very abruptly. It's happened before, it could happen again, and that's the danger that we have. We have to stop this, and it's great that Tillerson is now face-to-face with on the front of climate science, and so it's a kind of a test for him there.
Right. ExxonMobil, he was the CEO of ExxonMobil, now Secretary of State. ExxonMobil, perhaps were part of the vanguard in terms of climate research, which they then spent millions of dollars to deny. But I hear you. There is an amazing challenge to the species, not just to nations, but to all human beings. And we will see. We'll follow the Arctic, of course. We've been joined by Greg Mello. He's a co-founder of the Los Alamos Study Group. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and clear.